Going great guns here on lecture 20. And it has to do with regional jinn. In other words, jinn influences in various parts of the Muslim world. You know, the Muslim world is so broad, isn't it? All the way from Morocco to Malaysia. Some years ago when I was doing my PhD dissertation called Islamic Ideology and Fundamentalism in Pakistan, colon, climate for conversion to Christianity, question mark, I remember thinking, wow, you know, over 50 countries in the world, in the Muslim world, not the Muslim world, in the world have a majority of Muslim, not to mention those who have, you know, a minority Muslims. So there is a lot of variety, and there's variety in this, variety in folk practices. By that we mean different names and some, you know, different spirits and stuff. But by and large, it's the same, you know, whether it's a Sufi cult or it's a some kind of practice. It's very familiar. In fact, my friend Dudley Woodberry used to say that having worked in Pakistan when he was giving lectures on folk Islam, that his friend Paul Hebert, who had been working with Hindus in India, could step in and give a lecture about folk religion among the Hindus, and it was very much the same as folk religion among Muslims. So we're talking about you know, regional jinn influence and the varieties. We talk first of all about Turkey, and you know, you'd think that because Turkey is well, it's a modern Muslim country, it's making progress, it's secular, in other words, in so many ways it seems different. Nevertheless, folk practices are very, very common there. And in Turkey, the jinn are very active, and the locations, unsurprisingly, are in the baths. Now, I don't see, unless this is supposed to be represent a bath, it's possible, but you know, the Turkish bath is famous, and anyone who's been there, I guess, it's quite the experience. But it's understood that jinn are also present, and they're of course there at the cemetery, at the foot of big trees, and also in toilets or garbage dumps. I don't see any toilets here, but there you have it. Often, again, understood that a black cat or a black dog represent a jinn. So when you're in the Muslim world, keeping an animal, especially in the house, is not the thing to do. Where we were in Pakistan, we had a dog for quite a few of our years, but the dog was always outside, and he was what they called a chokidar, a guard, or she, and you know, roamed around the roof or something like that. That was okay because a lot of Muslims see the need for that, but not certainly to keep them inside. Also notice that dwarfs or giants are suspect, you know, as far as the jinn are concerned. Maybe that's a jinn. So you can see how difficult it would be if you were a dwarf or a giant in Muslim culture that is heavy into this popular stuff. What about harm and precaution? In other words, well, the harm is from a jinn could be, you know, many, many things, but often paralysis is considered to be caused by a jinn. If you read Musk, you get this from the stories he tells of paralysis, and it's believed to be caused by an evil spirit. So what do you do? Well, you have to take precaution. You have to to do something to prevent it and from being attacked or being harmed by a jinn. And one of the things, as we've talked about before several times, probably you're sick of me saying it, this Bismillah stuff. In the name of God, you do this and that and everything else. Bismillah this and Bismillah that. But it's also understood to the felt needs. In other words, what are the felt needs? What do people feel? Obviously, there's a lot of fear. How could you not be afraid? Well, you know, if I go here or do this without doing the right thing, taking the precaution, or if my baby comes in contact with this person or that place, maybe harm will become, or perhaps that's what's happened already. Just imagine the fear. Just try to walk in their shoes if you can. There's also a lot of suspicion about one another. Well, maybe that person has put a curse on me or wants to put a curse on me. If she doesn't like me, maybe she's jealous of me, jealous of my beautiful daughter who's going to get married very easily, when her own daughter, if I might say, not so attractive, won't find a husband so easily. And then there's this fear of being unclean, isn't there? Unclean. And women in particular, I think, sense this and feel this, particularly because of the during the, you know, certain type of the time of the month, unclean, and Islam too. We can understand this, I think, from the Old Testament and references there to that for women, and so there is this in Islam that seems to be, dare I say it, condemns women for being women. How troubling this is. So what do you do? In other words, what are the amulets? What are done? Well, amulets are, understandably, they're Quranic, that are used against the evil eye. And here's a famous one. Here, right in the center of this amulet, in other words, right here, is a famous verse. They're all famous, but more famous than others, some. 68, Surah 68, and verse 51 and 52. This sounds very folkish, and the unbelievers would almost trip thee up, see, with their eyes when they hear the message, and they say, surely he's possessed. Now, this is quite a verse. The eyes of evil men look at a good man as if they would eat him up or trip him, says the commentator, 5633. But really, this suggests to me some spirit stuff. In other words, that the unbelievers would trip you up with their eyes. You see, the eye is the eye of envy. And, well, that's in the center. But on the margins, that's out here and here and here and here, is the 2 and 256, which is the famous old verse. Actually, it's 2, I think, 255. Allah, there is no God but He, the living, the self-sustaining one, eternal. But then in the middle of that verse, 255, chapter 2, His throne doth extend over the heavens. So that's the throne verse. You know, this is the verse really that's often used in the amulet, right out of the Quran. Around the corners here, by the way, when I said throne on the margins, I hope I didn't point, I might have pointed at the corners, but on the in the corners itself, in other words, up here, you can see that the chapters there are 112, 113, 114, and I've referred before. This, you can see, by the way, was done by one of my, you don't know, but it was done by one of my students who was very artistic, because you can't just take a picture because of copyright laws. So she reproduced it. And there, believe it or not, is Ali right at the top. Ali. Who's Ali? Ali is the, he's a hero. of the Shiites, the son-in-law of Muhammad, who married Muhammad's daughter, of course, Fatima, and then Ali's sons, Hassan and Hussein, took over, but Hussein is the one who suffered a great deal, and Shiites remember him. But Ali is the one, really. Ali is the one that Muslims love a great deal. I think in some way you can say that they love Ali more than they love Muhammad. If you go to certain areas like Mazar-e-Sharif, where there are lots of Shiites in Afghanistan, that's what you would understand. So amulets all over the Muslim world to help you. And the silver necklace with plaques and tubes to hold small amulet squares with Quranic verses. Maybe sometime in your travels, if you travel here and there in the Muslim world or wherever you might go, keep your eye open for these kind of necklaces. And it would be great if you could have one. Keep my eyes open, too, for these kind of things, as I like to take them to an end of class or whenever and show them, show and tell to students. Quran amulets, always Quran, you know, Quran amulets. Here is one that's sold in the Mosque of Shanghai. Where Shanghai in China? You see, you have Muslims in China as well. And it's used to defend against the jinn or other evils and produce health. You know, this is really what you want. You want health, you want good fortune. And so that's what Muslims are hoping for and depending on to get them through. I could have mentioned there under the last point, felt needs, your notes, you'll notice Gospel for Shame Cultures in the Evangelical Missionary Quarterly, July 1994. I don't know if you read the AEMQ or not, but that's an interesting article because it talks about how important, you know, shame is and how you get rid of it and free of it. So let me just mention that in passing. That the desire for cleanness is very, very important. Let's think a little bit about missiological implications and this clean or unclean thing. You know, we did mention the fact that often women feel unclean, and we don't like that. In other words, we want women to feel accepted. We want them to feel part of the group. We don't want them to feel left out or excluded for any reason. So what do we do? Well, I think that we should remind ourselves that there's no harm in being unclean. In other words, you remember the book of Leviticus and how that talks over and over again of how to get clean from this. It's just not women, it's everyone, really. If you do this, then you're unclean. You do this, you're unclean. And you have to do, you know, and so. And then it gives you the, you know, you get the idea that there's no harm in being unclean, but just don't think that it doesn't matter. And of course, the idea is to, you know, to, the understanding is that God is holy, and we need to be holy too, and we are holy through Christ. We are cleansed through the blood of Christ, and this introduction, perfect introduction in Leviticus to the Gospel and New Testament references of how Christ comes and he cleanses the leper. He does this and that, and his blood cleanses from all sin. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us our sin and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Isn't it a blessing, really? To experience that we are clean through the blood of Christ. Remember that Psalm in 24, Psalm 24, who may ascend the hill of the Lord, who may stand in his holy place, he who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to an idol, or swear by what is false, he will receive blessing from the Lord. This is a psalm that is the favorite psalm sung by the Punjabi Christians in Pakistan. They love to sing the songs, psalms. And this is the favorite one. Rabb Khudavand Badshah Hai, Ya Khudavand Badshah Hai. And they sing it over and over and over again. It's a great song. They sing the Zaburs, the psalms of David. Who is this King of Glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O you gates, and lift them up, you ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. You know, Jesus is King, and this is our witness. This is our belief that through him we can be ready to meet God. He helps us. I wanted to end with this question. Why might the handicapped be more receptive? One of my former students from Germany, whose name is Sabine, works in North Africa. She is in a wheelchair herself, and she went out there and she helps work with Muslims. She imports wheelchairs through Joni Erickson Tada. And I personally think that she has a great ministry. It's difficult for her, though. But I sometimes think of the fact that the handicapped in Muslim countries are more receptive to the gospel. Why? Because they've been rejected for various and sundry reasons. And I think that's probably true here as well. So we need to remember those. Remember even, you know, the deaf and people like that. People who are challenged, how we need to be sensitive to them and the fact that God loves them and God cares for them. And there are many of these people in the Muslim world just roaming around, oftentimes totally neglected. And so they need to be reached with the gospel as well.